What is up, everybody? Adrian M. Gibson here. What you're about to hear is the audio version of a live author panel recorded at TBRCon 2023. TBRCon is an all-virtual sci-fi, fantasy, and horror convention that I directed and organized and was founded by David Walters of FanFi Addict. And this year we had the pleasure of hosting 30 author panels, which were absolutely amazing, and I highly recommend checking them out. But since so many of you listen to podcasts and prefer that over watching things on YouTube, I have published this live author panel here on the SFF Addicts podcast feed. I'll be releasing a new author panel every Friday until they run out. So until then, sit back and enjoy this week's TBRCon 2023 author panel. Enjoy. Welcome, everyone, to a TBRCon Day 2 panel. I hope you're all doing well. And today, I'm very excited for this topic. What we're going to be chatting about today is the intersection of nature and technology. And very, very excited for all these authors who are with me today to dissect it. We can introduce ourselves one by one. So I'll just say your name, and then you can tell us a bit about yourselves. First up is Veronica Roth.
You make me go first. Okay. I'm Veronica Roth. I'm probably best known for the Divergent series, which is for younger readers, but lately I write for adult readers, which always sounds like a scandalous thing to say. My upcoming book is Arch Conspirator, which is a futuristic retelling of the Greek tragedy Antigone. I just had a dystopian mystery, Poster Girl, come out in October.
Awesome. And next up is M.R. Carey. Mike, how are you?
I'm very well. Thanks, Adrian. Yeah, I'm Mike Carey. I also write as M.R. Carey. I wrote Girl with All the Gifts, the Coley books. I wrote Lucifer. I wrote X-Men for a while. Comics, novels, whatever anyone will pay me for, really.
Just give them that money, people. Come on. And next up, Tade, I'll toss it to you.
All right. Hi, I'm Tade Thompson. I write books, short stories, novellas, screenplays, and stuff that you may never have heard of. I think my best known work is Rosewater, and I also wrote the Molly Southbourne books. I think my last book is Jackdaw. I've written horror, I've written science fiction, I've written crime. I'm all over the place, and like Mike, I will do whatever they pay me for. I'm a hack, in other words.
At least divide it up between Mike and Tade. And Kritika H. Rao, how are you?
I'm well, and apologies. I'm at work, actually, so I'm kind of be going in and out just because the Wi-Fi is a little iffy here. So hi, everyone. I am Kritika H. Rao. My debut epic science fantasy is called The Surviving Sky, and it is coming out on June 13th from Titan Books. I've been writing epic fantasy ever since I actually started writing, which was a while ago, but this is my debut book, I'm super excited about it. I'm super excited that this panel is about nature and technology, because there's a lot of that in The Surviving Sky. It's about plant-made cities floating above jungle storms, ready to crash to the earth, and this husband and wife are trying to figure out their marriage as they're trying to save their world, and it's just a whole lot of drama and a whole lot of oh my God, get your shit together. So it's a lot of fun. Yeah, so excited to be here.
Awesome. Well, thank you for joining us. And last up, the great Claire North. How are you?
I am all right. Thank you. I am Claire North. I'm also actually really Cat Webb, best known for the first 15 lives of Harry August. And right now I'm on a Greek bender with a book called Ithaca, and it's a trilogy. It is about Penelope, wife of Odysseus, trying to run a kingdom for 20 years while her husband has pissed off.
Love it. Love it. I love how you call it a Greek bender. Just a little jaunt over there. All right. To start off the discussion, I would like to know how each of you personally perceive the relationship between nature and technology. You know, are these distinct things in your mind, or has the intersection more or less blurred in your day-to-day life? So Tade, I'll give it to you first.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You're on the panel. Come on. Don't be surprised.
Here's what I'm going to do. Okay. I'm going to first of all present. Okay. let's talk about what technology is first. In order to give you my opinion, I have to tell you what I consider technology to be. And I consider technology to be the practical application of science, although you could say it's the practical application of knowledge. So when, and you'll know my answer by the examples I give, when a chimpanzee is trying to reach into a hole in the bark of a tree and sees ants there and tries to eat something in there and realizes that he or she cannot get in there with their fingers, but if they snap a twig and stir things up, it makes the ants come out.
Right.
And, you know, and therefore they can get to the food that way. That is actually technology, because an observation, i.e. using long stick, poke thing, bring food out. That's an observation. But the reproducible use of that observation to produce, you know, that result is technology. When you have, for example, a seven-armed octopus riding a jellyfish, and that may just be joyriding, but when it rides it and stirs it, and when you, the cameraman in your scuba gear, go near it and it turns the jellyfish stingers towards you, that's technology, because it's predictably doing those things that it has observed. And when the blanket octopus eats a Portuguese man of war and rips off the stingers and retains the stingers and then uses the stingers for defense, that is also technology. Now, my point or my position is that distinguishing between technology and nature is somewhat arbitrary because we humans are nature as well. And the things that we are using to build technology or as technology are as well parts of the earth. So we may be having what's called an arbitrary distinction here. Now, does technology have side effects? Sure. You know, are they deleterious to the planet and the environment? Yeah, that may be the case. But that doesn't mean it's not nature. Anyway, that's my position.
I like it. And you know, I think it is important to understand that there is a distinction between these things, but it also can get arbitrary at the same time. But there are so many complexities there that I feel like this is a discussion worth having, hence why I invited all of you. But does anyone want to jump in on what Tade said, but also elaborate in terms of how you personally view this intersection or this distinction in your own life?
Yeah, I can kind of jump in. I agree with Tari. I think often we just kind of forget that we are a part of nature, right? Like we almost look at nature as this, oh, let's go outside to the nature and, you know, put away our technology and our little gadgets away. And I think what we do is we other nature too much. We exoticize it too much without basically forgetting that we are a part of it, as Tari said. So when you kind of talk about them being two distinct things, I think we do view them as two distinct things, but I don't think we fully understand that we are a part of nature, right? Like we're constantly othering it. We're constantly exoticizing it. We don't engage with it. Like here we are part of the ecosystem, right? Like, but we're always like, oh, this is just this outside separate thing. Like we don't engage with it as though it is that we are a part of that system. We don't participate in it. And that's kind of where I'm coming from. So I don't necessarily think that they're two separate things, but I think in practicality, we view it like that and we engage with our world in that manner. We engage with our world thinking that we are the outsider, right? Like we are special, like technology is this thing that we, as human beings, we alone do this, right? It's a testament to our brilliance. Like our technology is this like proof of our brilliance often. But I don't think we understand just how intricately tied we are to nature. Right, as Tade mentioned, like we are so closely knit with it, and I think that gap in what there is and what we perceive, you know, I think that is the gap that kind of distinguishes technology and nature, oftentimes to a lot of us.
And it's that social and cultural development that has crafted this distinction, as opposed to nature doing anything to
in some cultures,
that. Yeah, right? Yeah.
In some cultures, like in Aboriginal cultures and First Nation mm-hmm. cultures, like, you know, you obviously have this respect and this, like, you know, interaction with nature. Like, it is, they are such a huge, you know, their entire belief system often is like centered around how they are a part of nature, right? Like, not necessarily, but I think in other cultures, like often in Western cultures, it's very much like this outside thing that you have to go conquer, right? Like, it's very much, you know, us against it kind of a thing. It's like, we don't necessarily feel like we are a part of it, that we must engage with it in a manner in which we would engage with any other part of our environment, right? Mm-hmm. It's just this outside thing.
Or from a writer's perspective, character versus environment.
Yeah.
Veronica, Mike, or Claire, do you want to get in on this?
You could take the Thomas Ligotsky view and say that although we're a part of nature, we're the part of nature that sat up and sort of knew itself, and therefore we're cursed by self-awareness, and that kind of severs us from the rest of the natural sphere. And technology is the sort of the bit of the role, the bit of the biosphere that we've sort of brought under our control and made into an echo or a shadow of ourselves. And you know, some thinkers would say we can only see that shadow. We can't get back to the natural world. The state of nature is something that we've lost and yearn for.
Or yeah, something. For sure. Veronica. Veronica, do you want to get in here?
I pretty much agree with what's been said, but I have always thought of technology as sort of our attempts at like exerting some control over our environment, which would be, you know, sort of nature, I guess. But it is a false dichotomy. So, but I don't know. We are distinct in a way. We expand rapidly and without regulation a lot of the time. So I think that's where some of this tension comes from. We're just because of our awareness of ourselves, because we trust in our intelligence to master our resources in a way, like whether for good or for ill, we tend to interact with our environment in like a different way than other creatures.
Yeah, for sure. Claire?
I think there's two things that kind of, I mean, I agree, but also that's something I want to pick up on. I think on the cultural angle, I think it's very interesting that our relationship with technology has evolved over time. So for example, if you look kind of a long, 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 long way back, you've got kind of, again, that respect of the indigenous people, the Aboriginal people, and again, the animist traditions of the nature is the power, the God, etc. Mm-hmm. But then you also get the monotheist traditions going, nature has been made by a creator for humans. Humans are above it all, which then gets shaken up massively when the Renaissance comes along and goes, have you spotted that we are orbiting a sun, not the other way around? And suddenly there's this massive existential shift in how humans relate to nature. And there's this idea that technology has almost come along and massively disrupt our sense of how we interact with the universe, what our place in the universe is, and how that relates to the world around us. And then you get to the Enlightenment, the Industrial Revolution, where suddenly it's all very, we are the masters and the conquerors of nature. And so you get this massive cultural journey from humility to arrogance, to uncertainty, to arrogance, and now in the 21st century, to a sense of, oh, damn, we got that wrong. So I think it's very interesting that relationship is constantly evolving. And just on kind of the idea of technology as almost a predictive algorithm, I think I agree that there's a really strong evidence for that. But by that extension, anything ticking many bars of sentience can be said to be used as technology. Fish use rocks to break into their shells of things they wish to eat. There is a technology there. But I think what's interesting about humans is not just the predictive algorithm and that manifestation of sentience, but the ability to transmit it down the generations. The languages of mathematics, indeed the language, spoken language, allows us to transmit our technologies, but also our cultural ideas of its value down generations. So it's quite hard to separate our relationship with technology and our relationship from nature with our relationship with ourselves at any given moment, I think, in our cultural history.
And at that point, would you call literature a technology in that sense? Because it is a transmission of knowledge. Tadet, you had a point?
Yes, although, you know, to address what you just said, literature totally is, you know, it is a technology. You know, we're transmitting, not, you know, stories are ways of transmitting of what Claire just mentioned, transmitting our knowledge, the way to behave from the narrative cave paintings. All right. Mm-hmm. It was more like, look, this You can use long spear to kill bison, and you can do that again if you try to do it. Several of you have to go after the woolly mammoth. Not one person, a lot of you can go. You know, you're transmitting knowledge in the form of stories, and it's, you know, we tell children stories to, you know, to enculture them, to, you know, to teach them about these other things we do, and culture is part of that technology of transmitting that knowledge of, hey, look, I used a rock. All right, a sharpened rock, and it's a knife, you know. And then, like, you go to and say, "Hey, look, it's a knife. It's a rock, but it's a knife. It's a rock, but it's a knife. It's fantastic," you know. But what I was going to say before any of that is that if we take this arbitrary thing called nature, and we take human beings, we were never going to get along because nature wants to kill you always, always. Okay, we were never going to get along. All right. This is the reason we live in houses. All right. We live in houses because nature wants, we went into caves because nature wants to kill us. Mm-hmm. All right. Everything out there wants to kill you, imbibe you, digest you, and, you know, use your energy. Whatever energy is in you, they want to use it. What we have done over time is to delay that destruction more and more and more. That's what we've done. We've delayed that destruction. But we were always going to come against what we perceive to be nature. Technology was always going to bring us against nature. We were never going to get to that. Yep.
Wouldn't you consider the cave a part of nature too, though? Like, I'm finding it a little hard to wrap my head around the idea of nature being so alien and separate from who we are. And I agree that, you know, that nature is trying to kill us, but that is not unnatural. You know what neither I mean? That very phenomenon is quite natural. Like, that happens, like, that's just life.
Neither is a femur that I use to kill a predator. It's also part of nature, but it's technology when I use it as a weapon to hit the head of something.
Like an alternative purpose.
Yeah. So you're using part of it. We use nature. I mean, look, even if you think about, we mine iron, we use iron ore, we get iron and we use it to make tools. It's still part of nature. It doesn't make it not part of nature. Technology itself, like, you know, like I said in the beginning, technology itself, we're part of nature and everything, but even if we arbitrarily separate ourselves, we're always going to be in some kind of argument with nature.
Claire?
Maybe it could be then hypothesized that technology is just the great imbalancer. Stick with a sharp stone on it, things fairly basically evened out. The saber-toothed tiger ate the human killed the pups, the pup meat fed the carrion crows, which fed on the corpses left behind. Like, things roughly balanced out. And maybe you could make an argument that the advent of technology is actually what has set up this nature-technology divide, in as much as an ecosystem that ticked along perfectly fine with everyone eating each other in roughly equal numbers has now been massively disrupted by a group of bipedal people with thumbs going, but what if gunpowder? I don't know.
That theory of balance, sorry.
Go, Mike.
We think of ourselves as the stewards of nature, and we think of ourselves as being completely in control of our environment. But actually, at this point in our history, we're more like the bacteria that have sort of like grown all the way to the edges of the Petri dish, and there's nowhere else to go. We're using up our resources.
Mm-hmm. All of this has kind of got me thinking about, you know, what technology, or at least, you know, what our uses of things that can be perceived as technology say about our place in the natural world, because we do in our minds have this separation impulse to other ourselves from nature. But, you know, the more we separate ourselves, the more we're creating this perception that nature, or Kritika, you brought this up before about how, like, you know, the wildness of nature, this other thing, but there's also a danger present there, or an unknown.
It's sexy,
entity.
Right? Like, it's sexy. That's what it is. Like, you go out into the nature and you're just, you know, you're like, it's this like new thing that, you know, again, I don't know very much of it, but I want to be a part of it, not realizing that, you know, we are a part of it. And, you know, I think that's the thing. Like, we kind of live with these like blinders often, you know, sit in our little offices, go to our little homes, you know, sit in front of our gadgets and our laptops and this and that. And then when we want to unwind, like, and again, this is a very basic like interpretation of it, but this is also the most common interpretation of it, right? Like, technology mimics nature in so many ways, but I don't think when we think of technology, we don't necessarily think of how it is intersecting with nature to that respect. Like as Claire said, you know, it feels like an imbalance, or it feels like that, but I don't necessarily think that's true right now. Like machine learning algorithms, like all of these things mimic, like, you know, phenomena that is observable in nature right now. Medicine has that too, right? Like it's so clearly, like, we are making those, you know, connections, but I think for a general normal human being, we don't see that. Like, you know, it's all kind of happening behind the scenes, etc. Yet again, creating that divide between, you know, us and nature, and technology being this thing that kind of, you know, moves like a pendulum between the two.
For sure. Veronica, do you want to get in here?
No.
Well, don't make that face every time I ask you. I want to include you. Come on.
I appreciate that, but no, I'm good.
Okay, well, let's get on to it.
Throw something out there as
Go like, tell it.
Not all ecologists agree in the whole balance of nature thing. Like, not all ecologists agree that nature was ever in balance or is even intended to be in balance, and that there's actually a lot of chaos that happens in nature, that is supposed to happen in nature, and that the time that we look at, the time periods we look at, are actually rather short when you think about deep time, deep geologic time, and that chaos is actually part of nature. You know, it is actually not necessarily designed to be balanced, it's designed to be chaotic, and lots of shifts happen over time.
It's not static, right? That's the thing, we think of nature as being static, but it's not.
No. Claire, I want to toss this to you, but you can also elaborate on this point. I want to bring up natural disasters, because this is something that comes up very often in science fiction, sometimes in fantasy as well. But I feel like a natural disaster is the sort of pinnacle of our confrontation with nature. You know, we face a disaster like an earthquake or a tsunami or something like that, and it's this blatant representation of what nature can do to us, and the chaos, Tade, that you brought up in terms of the devastation that it can reap upon, you know, what we've created as our normal in terms of civilization and cities and all this kind of stuff. Claire, do you wanna get in on this natural disaster thing? But you can also touch on the comment that you held your hand up for.
Oh, I was holding my hand up to say I completely agree that nature is all about ecosystems growing and collapsing and growing and collapsing over billions of years. But if we are putting humans on a pedestal and saying, goodness, we've got great predictive algorithms, isn't that sexy? Then the fact that we are the cause of a current natural collapse should really make us look long and hard in the mirror. That was going to be the caveat to the, yes, it all goes, ooh, but ooh. on disasters, I think the first thing I want to say is actually a lot of the time disaster movies and books, I mean, obviously you think of movies because you think of big budgets and you think of tsunamis and stuff. But a lot of the time, I think both disaster movies and books tend to be more about people than it does about actual humidity in the face of nature, if that makes sense. I think there's an awful lot of look at this disaster, see how these plucky yet divided people come together to make something mighty out of it. Wow, the human spirit. But also, look, there's a cannibal in a corner. People can go dark. And very rarely is it actually stopping and going, have we considered the wonder and the majesty of nature? It's there, but a lot of the time it's still as a tool to almost human hubris. I think that is shifting a bit. I think as we get more existentially anxious about the things we've done to the planet, I think possibly that is beginning to evolve. But most of the time it's a family with a dog, but there's a cannibal and we need to get to a place where we'll have agency.
We're looking at you, Cormac McCarthy. Go Tata.
I was going to say, I mean, the reason we have lots of natural disasters, natural and unnatural disasters in books and films and all of that, is because it's dramatic. Drama is what we're trying to create, and what's more dramatic than having a gigantic tsunami? Before we became self-aware, before hominids decided to be what hominids are, disasters were happening. Nobody just noted it. Nobody just like, yeah, it was just like, yeah, okay, it's Tuesday. There's a tsunami. Fine. You know, nobody cared. You know, nobody cared because nobody was noting things down and, you know, and transmitting it up to wherever it needed to go to. Disasters happen. That's pretty much the way. But at this point, I think I should mention a book, you know, since, you know, we're all talking about, but I should mention a book called A Paradise Built in Hell by Rebecca Solnit. and it's a nonfiction book, but what it explores are the ways in which people come together after an actual disaster, as opposed to how it happens in films and books. Like, what do people actually do? And it turns out people are actually quite supportive of each other.
As opposed to eating each other.
As opposed to putting on, you know, heavy metal gear, you know, and kind of luckily help each other. And I think we forget that human beings, I know the world seems really bad, but human beings are essentially decent,
Yeah.
You know, I actually have hope for the human race, because we're essentially decent. We're essentially decent people. We just, you know, I think the bad ones are just too noisy. But I think that, no, it's true. That's what I think. You know, that's what I think. There's a lot of noise. We pay more attention, and we're designed. Our brains are designed to pay more attention to bad news because it's a survival kind of instinct. You need to know what's dangerous and everything. But in actual fact, most humans are decent.
You're just describing Twitter now, aren't you?
Veronica, you're shaking your head. Get in here.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I don't agree about, like, that humans are essentially decent, just as a side note. But we can argue about that some other time. But I do think one of the appealing things about writing, like, dystopian fiction in particular, but also anything, like, I don't know, anything futuristic, any whatever, we like to test our own resilience through stories. And so I think the natural disaster story is a lot about, like, okay, well, if you took away all of the fanciest tools that we have, like, what would we do? We'd have to kind of, like, go back to our roots and band together and, you know, conquer this, like, devastation or something. So I think that's part of why they're appealing, like Claire said, more about, like, the way that we relate to each other in the wake of, like, that total loss and that helplessness. How we, like, reclaim power and stuff like that. So I think that might be part of the appeal of the natural disaster. Certainly not as much a commentary. I'm trying to think of, like, the last time a natural disaster movie made me think about the wonder of the Earth. I'm like, no. They're pretty much about, like, look what this bitch the Earth did to us.
Yes, nature wants to kill you. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, have you ever been in the ocean? It's literally throwing you out of it.
Mike, I want to get your take, because you set your Rampart trilogy in a post-apocalyptic Britain, and that was a book that got me thinking about nature, more so than just it's an apocalypse. This is pretty bleak. Do you want to comment on sort of like the use value of an apocalypse, a natural disaster, that kind of thing? But like from a narrative perspective, trying to navigate this kind of dichotomy between providing an entertaining narrative, but also getting people to like think a little bit, as opposed to more brain dead, big budget disaster movies and that kind of stuff.
I don't want to make any grandiose claims for the Rampart trilogy. It's just about trees.
Philosophical maestro. No.
but going back to you were talking about the role of literature in this, and this sort of touches on what Claire was just saying. There's a book by a guy named, I think, Brian Boyd, of the University of Auckland, called The Origin of Stories, which makes a Darwinian case for storytelling. It argues that storytelling is an adaptive mutation of humankind that serves roughly the same purpose as play behaviors do for baby animals. You know, kittens learn how to hunt by playing. Human babies tend not to, but stories can extend your behavioral repertoire. They can introduce you to situations that you haven't met yet, and you can test yourself out against them. And I think science fiction does that sort of better than almost any other kind of story. Science fiction has been telling us for three generations now that we're running out of world, that our relationship to the natural sphere is changing in alarming ways, and that we need to start thinking about this stuff. And I think that does, it's kind of reductionist. Obviously, stories do a lot more than that. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a valuable thing that stories can do.
Yeah. Claire, go for it. I know you love apocalypses. Come on.
Well, I was going to say, one of the great narrative advantages of an apocalypse is it is much easier to write than 30 years of failing to take fossil fuel emitters to court, followed by 70 years of trying to clear up after the floodlands and the deep and complicated policy decisions and economic discussions. Like, an apocalypse can be sharp and snappy from an average point of view. And it is genuinely a narrative problem that when we do talk about our relationship with nature, it's actually quite difficult to go to a macros level. It's a difficult challenge as a writer. It's also a very difficult challenge as an environmentalist activist. How do you get us away from there's a family and a dog to the macro idea and the scale and the time scales over which nature works? How do you say over 70 years, you may experience this story of interpersonal strife, but over 300 years, look at the world? It's a very difficult challenge politically and narratively. And also thinking about apocalypse, so I realised I just wanted to flag one of the earliest, which was A Family and a Dog, which is Noah's Flood. You can't get more family and
more
a dog
than
an apocalypse. But also, it's the most human-centric example of the genre.
You mentioned Noah's Flood and Tade's eyes just lit up. Go for it.
No. My eyes lit up as a really great example. I'm not, you know, like, yeah, it's really great. I'm just, you know, that's why I said that. What I was going to say, though, is that one of the problems that you described, the problem is that our brains were not designed to think about 3,000 people or 3 million people or that amount of time into the future. These brains weren't for that. These brains were for small groups of primates, all right? These brains were for a small area, a small hamlet, and definitely not a city, definitely not a global view. That's not what these brains were designed for. So it's very difficult not to have a family and a dog to lead us into the knowledge of the apocalypse because, mm-hmm. yeah, 3 people dying, those are murders. 30 people dying, that's a tragedy. But when it becomes 3 million, it's abstract. It's abstract. You know, it's very difficult for the human brain to say 3 million people and contain that. It becomes abstract. You know, mm-hmm. it becomes
I'm
something
so
that...
glad that we've had a Stalin quote.
Well, yes, we have. I had to sneak it in. But that's, you know, that's why Stalin could get away with the thing Stalin got away with, because people just won't believe it, because, like, I can't think of 3 million people dying. You know, so that, but that is the problem that we have. Sounding an alarm bell, because one, the dangers that we are designed to deal with are more immediate dangers than later dangers, so people can't see it. You say global warming and a person is saying, well, my heating bill was like triple what it was last year. How can there be global warming when I'm still, but you know, like, and these are questions that people ask, like, they can't think about the whole year and the average, you know, the median temperatures. They can't think of those things because they're too abstract, you know. So it is up to us who call ourselves science fiction writers to find ways, you know, to use literature as a technology to bring this into everyday awareness, because we're not quite there yet, because I still feel like we're not panicking enough about global warming. And I feel like because people don't get it. Mm-hmm. People don't get it. Like, look, I want to go to my job. I want to come back. I want to watch X Factor and I want to go to bed. You know, people don't really get it yet. If they did, they would be a lot more panicked.
Yeah.
I swear I'm going to try and keep it short because I don't want to hog space. But I think there's also a very similar interesting thing about technology. When we look at technology, it tends to be interpersonal micro stuff. It's very rarely in our science fiction do we talk about technology on a gigantic scale. Our technological disaster, technological apocalypses, and our use of technology also tends to be a family and a dog rather than millions of people have been affected by technology X. It's interesting. It's actually a very similar narrative crossover in terms of how we struggle to think about the macro on that. Mm-hmm. End of.
Boom. Mic drop. This kind of gets into something that I've been thinking about a lot, which is memory. You know, Tada, you mentioned the fickleness of just the human mind when it comes to conceptualizing things that are grander than an individual or a group or a community or what have you. But I also think, you know, Mike, we touched on this earlier in terms of, you know, literature as a form of technology. I think that's kind of like a roundabout way of for us to deal with how shitty our brains are. Sometimes it's like the transmission of memory through technology. And now we're at a point where we have smartphones where we can search things up. And that's kind of dampening our ability to improve our own memories because our reliance on technology becomes greater and greater and greater the more we have smarter and smarter machines or smarter and smarter creation. So I wanted to get all your takes on this idea of sort of like memory in conjunction with our relationships with technology or the things that we develop, but also just, you know, the fallibility of the human mind.
It's neuroplasticity, isn't it? Yeah. That's the problem. The fact that our brains are so goddamn malleable that every tool we pick up to use uses us and changes us. There was a book I was reading a few years back now, and I can't remember who wrote it. It was called Amusing Ourselves to Death. I think it was by a guy named Postman. And he made the point that in sort of like societies that were largely pre-literate, societies were before mass education, when most people couldn't read, There's evidence that their attention spans, their ability to concentrate for long periods of time, was better than ours is. He used the example, maybe contentious example, of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, where Lincoln would talk for 3 hours, and then Douglas would stand up and say, "Look, it's not fair. These people haven't eaten yet. They should go home and have a bowl of porridge or something, and then come back, and then I'll talk." And people did, you know, very, very large numbers of people did, and stood and watched and listened for those extended stretches of time. Whereas now that we can rely on a smartphone, now that we can look up a smartphone rather than actually thinking about something, our attention span is like that. It's it's there and gone. We're learning to outsource our brains.
Yeah. It's like our decisions to use things affect us in ways that we might not perceive immediately, because it does take time. Obviously, neuroplasticity is not an immediate thing, but in this, like, our reliance on these things is kind of normalizes, because it takes so long. It's like this slow creep of our not necessarily dumbing ourselves down, but it's kind of like Kritika, sorry.
So, I mean, Adrian, when you started talking about memory, like, you know, again, like, I think we have this conception of memory being like, you know, just kind of remembering knowledge or information and that kind of thing. But I mean, there's different kinds of memory, right? There's like physical memory too. There's, you know, muscle memory too. And I think, again, like, I know I keep kind of going back to this, but I feel like as we kind of look at things in isolation, that is when we really start to see the separation in so many, so many ways, right? Like, again, memory, again, if you only think of it as knowledge, and if you only think of it as information or even literature, something we read or listen to, or and all of that. Mm-hmm. But there's so many different kinds of memory as well. Like, I think here's my thesis. I think we have very little understanding of ourselves as human beings, that any knowledge that we have of the world around us is so incomplete, and that extends to technology, and that extends to nature, and that extends to all of those things. I think, like, this is where a lot of my fiction comes from. Like, I tend to explore themes of identity a lot, and themes of how people explore themselves and learn about themselves while they're learning about the world outside of them. And in The Surviving Sky, this is, again, you know, a plant-based world and all of that, but the characters learn more about themselves through the journey, and you've read the book, as they do about the world and by extension their universe and all of that. And it's based on Hindu philosophy, which is something that, you know, I find myself returning to very often. But it is... that is the central theme, that, you know, we don't necessarily know ourselves very well, let alone any of the factors around us. So when you do say memory, I'm like, well, why are we thinking of memory only in terms of like knowledge or information or data that, you know, is, you know, I just remember this thing, or, you know, I'm just going to look it up on my phone. A phone is not going to teach us how to walk or to breathe or to swim or to, you know, any of those things. It could, you know, but you know what I mean? Like, there's just different types of memory. And I think looking at them in isolation is a bit of a disservice to our own engagement, again, not just with nature, but also in the many different ways that technology can develop and is developing to assist us either in understanding nature or doing better by our world or becoming better versions of ourselves, you know. Theoretically, I want to believe what Tade said, you know, that, you know, most people are decent, but it also kind of like makes me think. And again, this is memory again, right? Like societal memory. Was COVID a natural disaster? I would make the case that it was. You know, it's a natural disaster is not necessarily a tsunami or a forest fire or anything. Mm-hmm. I think the pandemic is a bit of a natural disaster too. And, you know, and years from now, what is the memory that we're going to have of that, right?
Mm-hmm. So Veronica,
there's so many different aspects to it.
Yeah, Veronica, do you want to build on this? Because you play with memory quite a bit in some of your work. You know, even in Arch Conspirator, there's like the memory of genes. I think is a really, really potent thing. Like, we humans are so self-obsessed that we're starting to think about the ways in which our genes can be manipulated or transcend one generation to a next, or so many things like this.
Yeah, I think one thing that's fascinated me of late is generational trauma, just the idea that we can kind of inherit these patterns from from our, you know, ancestors, people beyond us. My mom is researching it because my grandfather was a Holocaust survivor, so it's become like a thing in the family. I think one thing that I've been thinking about is how much we over rely on our memories. Like, they're actually not that reliable. Every time you recall something, it changes a little bit. And also, like, I don't know, even our cultural memory is a little flawed. Like, when the pandemic began, remember it being like, this is the first time this has happened ever. And actually, we're repeating like the same behaviors that we did during, you know, Spanish flu. Like, it's just, we do the same things at the same times. I was also reading Severance by Ling Ma when the pandemic started. And some of the things in that book were the exact same things people were doing. Like, you can predict what people are going to do, but we always feel like we're experiencing something for the first time. I feel like we'd be better off if we understood what we had done before, but, you know, that's a whole separate. We could talk about the whole history repeating thing ad nauseum, so I won't. But, yeah.
Tade, go for it.
Sorry, just a point of, so you mentioned genetic memory. It's not just genetic, it's also epigenetic. So it's not only the genes that transmit things in, you know, in groups across generations, but also the proteins around the genes also transmit that information. It's just a matter, it's probably better to call it generational memory, because it's not just the genes, it's also transmitted by epigenetic material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Does anyone else wanna touch on what's been said so far? Claire, go for it. Don't be hesitant.
I've just crossed epigenetics off my notes list. Thank you. I would like to flag how much artificial memory is currently having to learn from nature. So, for example, there was an interesting simulation done fairly recently, I think, in which essentially a slime mold was given the same problem as a computer, which is a pathfinding problem. And the computer did 10,000 calculations and found the best path. And it took the computer 30 seconds to do its 10,000 calculations. The mold took months, but it only sent out 8 tendrils. So instead of having to do 10,000 calculations, it did 8 calculations. And the reason I bring this up is because we often kind of talk about technological memory, oh, it's changing how our memories work. But actually, most technological memory kind of studies are being modeled on how nature works, is being modeled on organic memory, because fundamentally the human memory is incredibly unreliable because it has to be incredibly efficient. If we remembered every single bit of sense data that came into us and then reconstructed memory based on the sensory reconstruction of that data, we would melt down because there would not be enough energy to consume this process, and our brains would be the size of houses and we'd die immediately. We have had to make modular sacrifices, and the best way to make that modular sacrifice is to make a prediction. I see a thing, I make a prediction about that behavior, and then to store that prediction not as a sensory input, but as a story, as very literally a story. And a lot of artificial intelligence does the same. It's not recording a sensory input. It is compressing a sensory input down to essentially an algorithm. It is attempting to create predictive models.
An algorithmic story. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's faster. It is literally impossible for there to be a system currently with their technology to record all sensory input all the time, because time does not stand still. And so we talk about kind of technology and memory, but actually the intersections are very, very similar. Technology is often modeling its development based on the patterns in nature, but also technology is inhibited by the same fundamental problem that nature has. If you have a memory the size of a planet, there is not enough energy to sustain you. Something has to give. It is the same problem technology that evolution has always had. There has to be a modular payoff somewhere. You want to remember everything, you go blind. Same thing with computers. You want to remember everything, you will overheat. There's always that evolutionary payoff, regardless of whether you're talking silicon or squishy, squishy cells.
I love it. Silicon or squishy, squishy. Go, Tade. Mike, go for it.
Oh,
Mike.
Okay. I was going to say, one of the disturbing sides of those shortcuts is it makes it eminently hackable machines. I think I lost the connection.
I just wanted to quickly follow up.
I was thinking of Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah, Mike, you're a bit choppy, but go ahead. No one will interrupt you.
Sorry.
Go for it.
The Cambridge Analytica scandal, you know, the sort of manipulation of the Brexit vote by using people's social media feeds, which is all done with predictive software. And it was incredibly effective. Our behaviors in the mass are staggeringly predictable. There's an experiment that was done where judges were asked to give sentences for crimes, but they were asked to throw dice beforehand, and the dice were loaded so that they would either come up with a 3 or an 11. And those who were given the 11 consistently awarded higher sentences for the same crimes. We are that sort of at the mercy of our sensory inputs from second to second.
Mm-hmm. Tata, did you have a point?
Oh yeah, I was just going to say that I was going to buttress what Claire said. Actually, it is not desirable to remember everything, especially, for example, in trauma. You don't want to remember everything because you're going to end up as a wreck. You will be paralyzed. Mm-hmm. You don't want to remember everything. It's one of the reasons why we tell, memory is actually us telling stories to ourselves. And we are also the editors of those stories, because every time we recall it, we edit it just a little bit more, just a little bit more. It's never the thing that we thought it was before. Mm-hmm. But we edit it to suit the narrative we want to tell about whatever it is that we said happened in the past. So we make ourselves sound more heroic than we were in the moment, or we make the trauma of something, we alter the trauma of something so that we can survive, so that your present psyche, your present person can survive in some way. Because mm-hmm. otherwise, just like Claire said, it will be an overload. You will not be able to do anything. You will not be able to take a step forward or backwards or anything. You just stand still, because you will spend all the time reliving every single detail, every single sensory detail, and your commentary on it at the time, and other people's commentary on it, and so on. You can't take all of it. If they ask any of us about this panel tomorrow, we will have different stories to tell.
It didn't even happen.
Yeah,
go for it.
I was just thinking about how kind of unsettling but great it is that we can use this ability to edit, like after the fact, in a therapeutic way. Like now, if anyone's ever done EMDR therapy or various other kinds of like identity work or whatever, you can go back and recall negative or uncomfortable or traumatic memories, but like with a different context. So you can actually change the neural pathways in your brain just by like recall, which I think is very powerful and also very creepy that we can do that. Like, how can I rely on it if it's that easy? It's not easy to change, but it can be changed. So unsettling. Yeah.
Kritika, I'm going to get you in here first. Claire, you can go. Oh. Okay.
Well, it's just interesting to me how, the premise of all of this is that there is a one true thing or a one true event, even when that happens, whereas, everybody kind of experiences it in their own way. So there is no like one true fact. So yes, kind of going, memory is something that, yes, we can edit and we change and we do that all the time. But even the event in and of itself is constantly changing and moving and it's dynamic. Like it is not just one true thing, right? Like all of us experience the same thing in many, many different ways. And it's not just, and yes, we edit our own memory, but there is no like central, like this is the truth. You know what I mean? Like it's, everybody kind of comes to it from a whole different way. So while you're editing memory, even that the basis of what you're editing is not necessarily, the true reality of that situation. Mm-hmm. It's just, we'll be here a long time. It's just going back down that path. I'm like, we're not editing a fact. We're editing a version of a strain of that, maybe.
Yeah. And Tade knows all about this as a psychiatrist. It's like dealing with the concept of like this person's reality, their truth. Oh my God.
I'm trying to tell people about EMDR and you're a psychiatrist.
Even the concept of reality, what is reality? It's different for each of us and all that. So it's probably, it's probably a topic for another panel, because it will take, again, a long time to talk about what reality is and what is the truth, And while, epistemological discussions are interesting, I think they're beyond the scope of this particular panel.
Well, Claire, you had a point that you wanted to make earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Newtonian physicists right now are in tears over the idea there's no truth, but quantum physicists are on board with this. I was going to say, when we talk about truth, I think it's interesting because it feels like one of the cultural crises we've had of the last 10, 15 years is that technology has become a vessel for conveying lots of people's very different truths. And I think we've had a very long reverence culturally, well, not that long, maybe 200 years or so, but that's long enough to count, of if it is written, it is true. And obviously that's never, ever, ever been true in the history of humankind ever, but it has been instilled. There has been this reverence instilled. And so now everything is written. And even if it's not written, it's filmed, but even that is subject to deep fakes, or it's tweeted, or it's YouTubed, and there's panelists and they're speaking truths that are great. And there is still, I think, there has been almost a cultural crisis, I think, about, well, we know that what people say could go a bit of either way. Like, we understand that humans are unreliable memories, but seeing that, I think, through the medium of technology, through the medium of video and YouTube and blogs and newspapers online and all of that jazz, I think has thrown up complicated interactions in terms of how we use technology for that truth and how it also allows us to cherry pick on a much broader scale, I think, what truth it is we want to invest in. I think it was potentially easier before it became very easy to go down 4chan routes to pronounce your truth and have people turn around and go, nah, mate, that's fascism. And now you can use technology to, again, edit that prediction because we haven't quite sorted out our relationship with that.
Yeah, and this ties into this idea, this perceived truth for a very long time that humans were, Mike, you mentioned, the stewards of nature. And now we're at a point where we are questioning historical truths and cultural truths and things like that. And some people view humanity as the savior of nature. Other people view humanity as the destroyer of nature, you know? And on one hand, we have geoengineering and vaccines and green energy. And the other hand, we have nuclear weapons and fossil fuels and, you know, deforestation and all this kind of stuff. So I was curious to get each of your perspectives on how you feel about this notion of humans as stewards or saviors or destroyers, and how much of that lies in the hands of our species, or if that's just too fucking arrogant and humanist to think in that perspective.
We're not the custodians of nature. We're not going to save nature. We're thinking of ourselves. Mm-hmm. We're not going to destroy nature. We can't. Okay, we can probably destroy humanity if we really put our minds to it. Okay,
if we all just came together and destroyed ourselves. Yes.
But in the history of the world, we are a blip.
Yep.
We do not matter. I know we think we matter because of, you know, because we have our brains, and our brains are too large for just existence. Our brains are so large that we have to create scenarios for ourselves just to amuse the largeness of our brains. But in actual fact, we are a blip in history. If we consider the planet to have a history, all right, we are a blip. We will be forgotten, all right? Whatever else, you know, one of the things that gave me hope for nature was, strangely, in a nuclear reactor. When they found fungus in a nuclear reactor, it told me that the world will survive after us.
That's why, okay? I love fungus, man.
It will survive after us. We will be long gone, and this planet will continue. So when we're talking about destroying nature, we're talking about possibly destroying humanity. But there's not only us, you know, and if we can't even act in our own self-interest, do we deserve to live on the planet? Mm-hmm. Is a question that I would ask.
Yeah. Kritika, in your book, you have this. Oh, sorry, Mike, go ahead.
No, go after you.
Kritika, in your book, The Surviving Sky, it's like you have obviously a secondary world, but there is this kind of grand scale of destruction looming throughout the whole thing. Do you want to elaborate on what Tada and I have said, but kind of bring in how you approached your book with those things in mind?
Well, yeah. So in The Surviving Sky, like, I was very intentional about the fact that A, you know, they're escaping from jungle storms, and B, that they live in plant-made cities, like, floating above the jungle storms. So it's a bit of both. Like, they have, you know, they do other, you know, basically all of their planet where they're like, oh, the jungles are bad, you know, the storms are bad, you know, these cataclysmic, like, earth rages that come every now and then and wipe everything out. And the only way to survive for humanity is to kind of hover over it in, as it happens, plant-made cities. So, you know, you do have that, like, othering yourself from the rest of the planet, but also, like, kind of living with nature in a manner of speaking, where all of their architecture, everything is, like, plant-made. Like, you know, their lives are so reliant on plant, and it's living architecture. It's not, like, it's not static. It's very dynamic. That's, you know, architects, magical architects, essentially mold the architecture, and people kind of live within that. So for me, you know, that world and that premise, like, really offered, like, a way to kind of explore both how we are a part of something and how we can be so separate from it at the same time. Like, I agree with Tari. I think, like, we as a species, like we are here like for this much time, right? Like for us, it seems like it's forever. But, you know, in the grand scheme and, you know, how long, you know, Earth has been around, we'll come and go and life will still kind of survive. And I think in The Surviving Sky, that's really a question that the protagonist often kind of struggle with when they're thinking about the continuation of survival of their species, etc., is their place on the planet while they interact with like jungle storms to whatever capacity, while living away in like jungle, in plant-made cities. It was just a really natural way for me to kind of explore that relationship that we have with our nature, while kind of being outside of it, right? Like just like in The Surviving Sky, they're kind of outside of the planet nature, like they've molded nature to themselves in a manner of speaking, right. Which I think I would argue that we have done too in our little, you know, cities and our little, yeah, conservation forests and this and that.
Yeah. Mike, take it away.
I don't want to disagree with anything that Kritika or Tari has just said. I mean, I know we are a blip. Tiny, tiny momentary phenomenon in the history of the world, but I still find the idea of the Anthropocene age quite a compelling one. We're a blip that's had a profound effect on other species. The species that thrive, the only species that thrive in our world, ones that we have a use for. You know, the most plentiful animals, chickens and cows, are present in any habitat because we need them and we use them in fantastic numbers. And animals that we don't need, even if they're picturesque and beautiful and interesting, like giraffes and rhinoceroses and elephants, they die. We don't have the capacity to destroy the biosphere, but we have sort of wielded the power of life and death over countless other species, and we are currently presiding over a mass extinction, which is directly caused by human activity, which is a depressing and sobering thought, I think.
Yeah, Veronica, do you want to get in here? An arch conspirator. There's even, you know, the city in which it takes place. The surrounding environs is essentially a wasteland.
Yep.
So, from your perspective, it's like how does this like last bastion of, you know, at least in the context of this book, this last bastion of humanity within this city, how does that kind of tie into your own perceptions of humanity and their role on this planet?
Well, I think it's my philosophy is that we're doomed, basically. So when I write about the end of the world, it's not like with this hope that we're going to turn it all around. Like, I don't really don't really anticipate that. So I guess I'm with Mike. I'm very intimately concerned with the Anthropocene era. Like, I'm curious to know how we'll bring about our ending and if we can delay it and how we will try and what it all means if it's over. Like, you know, what kind of significance does that have in like a spiritual or moral or whatever? Like, I don't know. And that's kind of what I'm interested in exploring in my writing. But I'm trying to think. Oh, okay. So yesterday I watched this documentary called Rat by Mark Lewis, who also did the Cane Toads movie, which is probably the best known thing anyway, but basically like these two movies, Cane Toads and Rat, are about like these species that have proliferated certain environments. The cane toad was introduced to Australia in an attempt to control this like predatory invasive species insect, whatever, but then the cane toads weren't interested in eating that insect, and they also were interested in just multiplying and eating everything else, running rampant. And it's like a horror movie. It's the best. It's an amazing documentary. But Rat was interesting too, because like the rats are overrunning New York constantly. We're like in a constant battle against them, because if they don't control them, then there'll be like a 1,000,000,000, which I don't remember like what number that actually is. But anyways, we have to like constantly be killing them, otherwise they'll literally take over New York City. Which I just found interesting, the way that we function just like they do, though. Like if we didn't control, if we weren't controlled by external forces, who knows what we would do. But anyway, I was just thinking about that with like the species that survive are the ones we need. Not necessarily cockroaches, rats, cane toads.
Because we brought the rats to New York, didn't we? We brought the rats to New York.
They're there because of us.
They're not
and
even
fat because of our food and garbage.
We live in a symbiotic relationship with the rats.
They came in ships. It's the Norwegian rats. You know, the main rats in New York are like, one of them is from Norway. Yeah. You know, they're not actually native to American shores.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
We're just really good at spreading shit around, including ourselves. Claire, do you have any thoughts on this?
My thoughts are mostly with my hat on as an environmental activist, though I can tie it to books, I swear. So first thing, geoengineering got mentioned at the beginning. Geoengineering, terribly terrifying because only the rich and powerful can really do it. And they are very willing to screw over the rest of the world. So geoengineering, but cool for science fiction. Yay. One of the fundamental problems when thinking about the power of technology and the fact that humans are a blip and will be gone is that we really struggle as a species to find and answer the question of what is the point of us? Like, fundamentally, we all die, nothing lasts, what is the point? And organized religion has spent a lot of time going, well, the point is the afterlife. And that will give you your sense of comfort and moral purpose. And it's all spent a lot of time going, and you know the best way to get into the afterlife is to not kick up a fuss and obey your feudal lords. There's been thousands and thousands of years of that. And the reason I flag that is because a lot of the talk about the relationship between humanity and nature becomes nihilistic very fast, and therefore very difficult to write about in literature. It's very difficult to express it in an empowering way. But also, to Tali's point about people being decent, and Veronica's point about no one being decent, again, with my climate hat on, the thing I wish the entire world to take from this is that humanity's only really got two advantages over the dolphins. One, we can culturally communicate mathematics and technology. And two, we have to be a cooperative species. In the forests, if we walk alone, we get eaten by wolves. We have no choice whatsoever but to cooperate because we are dreadful at surviving under all other circumstances. Nature is out to eat us, so we have to work together. It is evolutionarily necessary to cooperate, and the single greatest way to cooperate is to behave within a decent social code where you don't eat other's grannies. Now, yes, we have eaten other people's grannies because the other is biologically very easy to reach to, but fundamentally, we are evolutionarily wired to cooperate because sharks have bigger teeth than we do. And when it comes to cooperating over climate change, it is hard because our brains are not wired for the macro. But the single greatest tool you have to bring about change is hope, not fear. Fear fundamentally is a paralytic. That is why dictatorships for thousands and thousands of years have been a bit like, don't rebel against your feudal lord, you will be punished in hell, and also torture chambers and prisons and stuff. It's also why right now, if you look at, sorry, it's turning to rant, but it's been important. If you look at the conversations about nature, it has always been the conversation of danger and oppression, and it's been the conversation of othering, and it's been a conversation of we must fight back. And it's also been a very capitalist conversation of we cannot possibly change our ways and live in closer harmony with nature because the economic cost, there are more billionaires than there's ever been in the world ever. But don't you worry about that because the economic cost will be too high. And so fear is how we die. We die afraid. We die afraid and we die crushed by this narrative of fear. Whereas the way you change is hope. Every single revolution in human history that has ever happened has come from hope. Hope that perhaps the feudal lords can be overthrown. Hope that perhaps we can bring about social justice and change. Hope perhaps in ending racial segregation. Hope in having gender equality in the vote. No one went out and campaigned for their rights because the fear was greater than the hope. They went out and fought because the hope was worth fighting against the fear. And so, yes, it's all very well to sit there and be terrified. The fear is good and correct, but the hope is how we survive, and it's also why Star Wars does so well. So that's my massive climate conversation. I know it's a tangent, but I think it's important. Sorry.
Veronica,
you approve of the tangent.
Yes. I just wanted to state for the record that my fatalism is not like, I'm not advocating for giving up. I just want to say that before we get any further. I'm just pessimistic, that's all, personally.
Yeah.
It's completely fair and valid. Completely fair.
On this topic of hope, though, I think it's really interesting. We're in a time where this hope is kind of mixing with fear of things like climate change or the eventual destruction of ourselves on Earth, not the Earth itself, with things like inhabiting other planets or, you know, basically just plucking humans and putting them on another planet because we fucked this one up real good. Tade, I want to get your opinion on this first, since you wrote a book about a generation ship with Far From the Light of Heaven. What's your take on this idea of, you know, sending humans, not necessarily all humans, but a section of humanity somewhere else to colonize another planet, and what that entails in terms of what Claire was talking about in terms of hope and fear?
Okay, so I will preface this by talking about the lottery problem. So more people who have won the lottery have lost a lot of their money, largely because they didn't know how to handle finances before they won a whole bunch of money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, you know where this is going. If we fuck this one up, we're going to fuck the next one up as well. Right? It is not the solution to our problem moving us elsewhere. It's like saying you're going to move, you know, you're going to have, like, so you have agar, you have bacteria colonies and everything, and you've got one petri dish here, and you grow bacteria on it, and it's taken over the colony, and you think, okay, and you couldn't find any antibiotics to kill it, but I'm just going to move one of them to another colony. That's not going to change anything, because it's going to multiply and grow there and make exactly, do the same mess will follow them. Because the mess is not, it's not that there are some doomed people on Earth, therefore we will leave them. We mm-hmm. carry our ghosts with us. Right, we carry our problems with us. So if we don't resolve, look, our problem is fundamentally a problem of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of things that, you know, Claire already mentioned, a problem of thinking about hope, a problem of thinking that, well, yeah, we have to consume all the resources to make all the profits because that's the important thing. Therefore, we cannot live in any kind of balance. We have to continue to grow, to grow, to grow. That's going to follow us. And most likely, the people who will leave the planet will be the richest of us anyway, you know? So that mindset is going to go with any colony ships. It is not the solution. Mm-hmm. It isn't at all the solution. What I was trying to show. So by the time, you know, within Far From the Light of Heaven, at this point, we've had several colony ships, and the particular ship that was going was just a replenishing ship. So in other words, either you were super rich and I had the super rich there, or you had a special skill that was needed on the colony, then mm-hmm. you could go. Most people could not really probably afford it, all right? But the same human problems that happen on Earth happened in the colony ship and happened on the colony itself, you know? And that's, you know, that is actually, it's the subtext of the entire tale. It's like, look, no matter where we go, we're going to carry our problems with us.
Mm-hmm.
So we pretty much have to solve the problems.
Yeah, agreed. Just a quick aside, my friend Crystal Matar is in the chat, and she's, I want to print out the quote, if we fuck this up, we'll fuck the next one up as well, and post it in her kitchen. beautiful. Kritika, go for it. You had your hand up.
I did, because, you know, when I was kind of thinking about this question, I feel like the problem, as Tade mentioned, is in our thinking, but primarily to me, it comes down to that colonizer mindset. You know, here we are thinking, you know, we will go colonize other planets and we'll go colonize Mars and this and that without having a full understanding of what, you know, what the context, the environment is like there. And that was the problem of colonialism, right? Like, that is why in so many ways we are suffering, you know, the effects of it to date. So even that language that is being used, right, the colonizing other planets, etc., I find it so problematic. Like, just across the bar, I find it problematic because it is a problem in our thinking. Here we are yet again thinking, like, you know, we will go conquer other places, you know, exactly. Not fully understanding what those other places might be. We have no idea what those, you know, other planets or systems, etc., will be like. But we're coming in with this arrogance, like, we are going to be colonizers, right? Like, that is the problem. Like, that is exactly why we've, you know, in so many ways, we've ruined our planet, because it has always been about conquest. It has always been about, like, you know, power. It has not been so much about participating. It has not been so much about, I am a part of this system. It has not been about, how can I also contribute to the balance, you know, in the system, whether that balance is, you know, and I agree that balance is not a static balance. It is a dynamic balance. And I don't think the two concepts are, you know, mutually exclusive, but we don't think like that. And I feel like, as Tari said, like, if if that is our thinking, then it is doomed. Like, it, you know, we are not setting ourselves up for success at all. And I'm all for going and exploring other planets. Like, I much prefer that terminology as opposed to, you know, becoming a colonizer with this set mindset. I have this agenda. I'm going to knock these things off my list. And that is what I'm going to go do on that planet. Like, to me, that is such problematic thinking. And every single time I see, you know, we're going to go colonize Mars, or we're going to do, I'm just like, oh, that word which carries so much like weight and, you know, just, you know, a wrong set of ideas in my mind, you know, connected to that word. If we continue to use that word, you know, for other planets and other systems, like, we're not going to do well. Like, I think we just, it's all doomed to fail. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mike, I want to get your opinion on this, because you, your next book coming out in March is about multiverses, but specifically a multi-Earths. So I'm curious how you approach this idea of, you know, other Earths through the perspective of like, well, this one's really fucked up. Like, we are messing up our own, or how you do this kind of compare and contrast between the different Earths that you created.
Well, my main character in Infinity Gate, Hadiz Tambawal, or one of the main characters, sort of fervently believes that most of humanity's problems are problems of scarcity. That it's a mismatch between humanity and the resources available to us. And therefore, if you could open up a few hundred or a thousand other worlds and just spread sideways into them, that all the other problems would magically disappear. Infinite resources means we conquer the other problems that we have as a species. I was thinking as Tare and Kritika were talking there about the logistical problem of evacuating a world, because even if you had the resources to build like a thousand spaceships a day and launch them with a thousand people in each one, and you did it every day for a year, people left on Earth with.
Have we lost Mike?
Population, while people are still. Much as the idea of a Martian colony might be nice, it's completely meaningless.
Mm-hmm. And Veronica, in the end of Arch Conspirator, I don't want to spoil anything. There's a big old ship waiting to launch in this city to evacuate the remnants of humanity. What's your take on all this?
Oh, well, there isn't an evacuation ship. It's a SOS ship.
It's more simple.
Ship.
It's more, okay. All right.
Yeah. I mean, it's a Greek, Antigone is a Greek tragedy. So let's like all embrace that my book doesn't end well. sorry, I'm trying to remember what your original question was. I just got myself into it.
Essentially, the idea that humanity can, you know, do better elsewhere and just kind of send ourselves to another planet and we'll figure our shit out, even though we didn't do very well here, as Tade so eloquently put it.
I mean, I think we've well covered that. I don't think it will work out for us. But like, logistically speaking, it doesn't make any sense anyway. I just read a book on interstellar travel that talks about how, like, really the only hope we have at traveling outside of our solar system is to find an abundant resource, or like be able to create large amounts of antimatter and also conquer physics. I don't know, it's like a whole thing. So seems impossible, but I do think it's interesting, like as a thought exercise, to consider what might happen if we began again. I'd love to see someone talk or find a way to like maneuver it, the generation ship, so that we're actually going to do a better job this time. Like, what would that look like? I'm curious. I can't write it. I'm clearly not that person. Someone.
Someone out there.
The problem of writing it and making it work removes a certain, I guess, cautionary aspect to the kinds of literature that we write. Because if we write, if we just go somewhere else, everything will be fine. Then it means we're trying to neutralize the requirement of us to make a change now, to change the way we think now, to change how we think about resources around us now. Mm-hmm. It will basically change, you know, like, especially if it's very successful, it will change the way we think about what we're doing now, because we're thinking in terms of escape rather than actually let's fix this now.
let's do what we can to fix what there is now. As to whether it can be done, it probably can be done. Whether, you know, and of course, depending on the skill of the writer, it could probably be made interesting as well.
On the scale
I'm
of
literally North. Writing this book. Oh my god! I know. I said I'm on a Greek bender. I finished the trilogy last year. I'm writing this book. I'm writing this space opera as we speak. I've done a binary star supernova, and you've got X amount of time before the radiation hits the planet and wipes it out. Ah! But I'm not really allowed to talk about it because I'm on a Greek bender. Sorry, but I just needed to scream that out because I'm literally writing the problem of how do you evacuate an entire planet, or where do you send people, and what goes wrong, and how do you make it work, and what's the societal thing required. And I think the main headline, apart from me going, is that the main theme of the symposium seems to be that neocapitalism sucks. Because most of the assumptions about how do we pick up and move to another planet work on, well, it works on two basic assumptions. It works, one, on the idea that scarcity is true, even though we literally have suns pumping out more energy in a single second than this planet could ever need. It works on the idea that a hierarchy based on wealth is true and valuable, and that's what gives you worth. And it works on the idea that power matters, essentially. Like it fundamentally cements these very toxic power dynamics. Neocapitalism does not get you in a healthy way to a new planet. Oh no. But then the other fundamental essential idea is I think that there's something sacred in humanity, because it's all very well saying, okay, let's hypothesize we managed to evacuate X number of humans to a planet, and let's say the gravity on that planet is 5% off, and the radiation shield from the magnetic core is 2% weaker than we're used to, and there's 3% more nitrogen in the atmosphere than you expect. That species is done for. Like, humanity is done for with just those tiny tweaks. And the way you survive that is by adapting humanity to the planet. You have to go in and take your technology to edit your species to be appropriate to the nature in which you are entering, which then leads to the whole question of, what even is human, my dude? Oh my god, I can see the trilogy! How far is too far to survive? So, yeah. That one, mates. How do you use your technology to edit your nature to fit into a new nature? Discuss.
Can I just point out, I just want to go on record in saying that if anybody could write that, Claire can. So, you know, whenever that comes out, you know. So Claire is that theoretical writer I was talking about. She can do it. You know.
But also hearing you say dude like that, just my brain, that was beautiful. This gets, Claire, thank you for the segue. You're brilliant. Why do humans feel the desire to manipulate natural processes within ourselves, especially with things like, you know, Veronica and in Arch Conspirator, there's like a lot of gene hacking, or at least like a lot of talk of genes and the way that genes transmit, or like what Tade mentioned, epigenetics as well. But then there's also things like transhumanism or posthumanism. Claire, if it's like, we're sending some people to some faraway planet, we're going to posthumanize the fuck out of them because they need to be very different than what they are here, because we are naturally adapted to function on this planet, nowhere else. But why do you think humans have that desire to augment themselves? You know, even if it's something as small as we love to have these things in our pockets, even though they're not connected to us physically, they are always with us and they are extensions of us. So that is like some small form of augmentation, if anyone has any thoughts on this.
I do. I could start us, but I was thinking about this because you sent us these questions generously in advance, and I was like, well, is the dumb answer like because we can, or we think we can, or we think we might? I do. One of the things that I like about us as a species, since, you know, I've been really trashing us this entire time, is how deeply, deeply curious we are. We're always asking questions, and we want to know what our limits are, and we are also convinced that we don't have them. So I think we have sort of like twin curiosity and arrogance. When our curiosity is compassionate and gentle, it leads us to very interesting places. But, you know, it can also be kind of like, when I think of technology as like a hammer, you can use it to build something, and you can also use it to smash a window. So mm-hmm. it sort of is shaped by our priorities and, you know, who has power, who we like give power to, or who takes power from us, and what their priorities are, which is always troubling, especially when it comes to gene editing. That's a whole separate thing. But yeah, in Arch Conspirator, it's a little bit, I am excited by what you're talking about, Claire, because it's sort of, it's a future scenario where we've made our environment toxic, and then we edit our genes in order to like be able to survive the environment that we've created. That's like the futuristic situation that's in Arch Conspirator. But of course, like in the story I wrote, it doesn't really work that well. But I am always interested in how we're always trying to improve like our experience, or see if it can be better. You know, sometimes I think that comes from curiosity, and sometimes it comes from a darker place, but we are very curious.
Indeed we are. Does anyone else have any thoughts on this? Krithika?
Well, as Veronica was talking, I was thinking, yeah, curiosity is a part of it, and arrogance certainly is, and, you know, the desire and the need to kind of control who we are and what we do and all of that. Power is such a huge part of it too, right? Like, again, like not to look at why we do it individually, but why we do what systems are we doing it to preserve, right? Like, why do people... I don't think curiosity is anything in isolation, you know, anything to be explored in isolation. I think when you kind of track back and you're like, why are people curious about this and not something else? It always, you know, feeds into a greater dialogue of society working in a particular way, or, you know, systems that, you know, we're trying to uphold or preserve or what have you. And I think a lot of that, like gene editing and things like that, to go inside of ourselves and tinker with, you know, with that is, I think it raises a broader question of,
I think
why are we doing it?
This is a broader question.
Why are we doing it in terms of, like, of course, because we're curious, but also what, you know, what we want our society to look like. And
exactly.
Right. And I think that is, to me, that is a very interesting piece of it, because, yeah, we're not doing it just because we're curious, as much as, of course, that is a huge part of it. Like, we're doing it because it is a means to an end. And what is that end, really? Like, you know, what does success look like? If we go in and tinker, and if we are successful, what is that successful image? And is it a good image, or is it a bad image? Mm-hmm. Or again, is it like a capitalistic narrative that we're just advancing, right?
Mm-hmm. Claire?
I 100% agree and want to invite more internet trolls by throwing down the word patriarchy, because I think that is fundamentally a power structure we're talking about. If you look at a lot of the tinkering we do with ourselves as humans, right now, for example, the thing that leads to mind is the wellness industry. You can ingest collagen and rub your face with acid and enhance all your manly parts and get surgery for all your womanly bits. And that's not just about being curious. That is about changing our bodies to fulfill a patriarchal ideal, and often a racist patriarchal ideal, that cements power structures in a really, really poisonous way. So I think I completely agree. I think that, again, we use the technology to tinker with our nature, but we're using that technology in a culturally imbued manner.
Yeah. And Tade, I wanted to get your opinion. I'm just going to set you up for something real quick, because in Rosewater, I love the way that you use xenoorganisms, alien organisms, and have people who are willingly, you know, merging themselves with these things. When you wrote that series, what were you thinking about in terms of that relationship between the xenoorganisms and humans, and how that kind of speaks upon what we would view as natural life, as it were?
So even what we view as natural life isn't natural. We're not, you know, we're more, so we're actually less human than we think. Like, you know, in terms of numbers, we've got more external organisms in us than actually human cells, and even what we consider to be human cells, actually, we've merged with lots of viruses and bacteria along the way, you know, along the way of becoming human. We're not exactly what we think, but some of the idea came from Nazi Germany, that if we had conquerors, some of us would be collaborators, some of us would fight. You know, we view collaborators with disdain, and we all think, yeah, well, I would never collaborate, but it's bullshit. People, both resistance and collaboration are both, they're adaptations to assault, right? people adapt in very, very different ways. It's all a means to survival. So you could say the person who is resisting is thinking of a larger group of people. In other words, I will go and sacrifice myself on the front lines and may die, but with the idea that we should all be free. Whereas the person who's collaborating is thinking of survival of maybe themselves and their own small group, but they're all adaptations. Mm-hmm. And the idea that we would have an alien invasion, an overwhelming alien invasion, and that all of us would fight is absurd from the start. That would never happen, right? So there will always be those who say, yes, I for one welcome our lizard overlords, all right? That was, you know, that was kind of part of it. But second of all, I also made it that, well, there are advantages to accepting, you know, some people have advantages. Some of them give you abilities, and there's healing, mm-hmm. you know. And when I wrote that, there was a big conversation about socialized healthcare going on, you know, in Western nations and all of that. So, like, okay, fine. What if aliens came down and all of us could get healed from all of our illnesses? And what would that look like? And what would it mean? And, you know, how would it be weaponized? And how would that change our very nature, if physically our nature has been changed? We think we're being mm-hmm. healed, but actually our cells are being replaced by a different organism. And would you be human or not human anyway? You know, at what point would you think that, actually, I'm no longer thinking like a human being? All of those are questions that I was trying to explore when I was doing that. Arguably, I wasn't a good enough writer when I was doing it, so I couldn't get to all the possible themes that, you know, that could be explored. But it, you know, that's what I was thinking of when I was doing that. It was more on those lines. And to kind of pivot back to the other question about why we like to tinker with mm-hmm. our thing, the root of all technology, in my opinion, is actually dissatisfaction, right? Even if you go back to the simplest technology, I can't crack this nut with my hands. I am not going to take it. I'm going to pick a rock and I'm going to crack the nut that way. And I can get to, you know, I'm going to crack it and I can get to the edible part that way, right? The rock is not, you know, it's very unwieldy. I have to chip off bits of it until I get mm-hmm. to some kind of weird axe handle. You know, like you're not satisfied by what is, and it makes you go further. When I started using a computer, a floppy disk was, you know, 1.44, you know, megs was great and everything. And all of a sudden you had a computer that had 256 megabytes, all right? Like 256 megabytes, all right? Like now I've got a phone that has like trillions of, like, you know, like, it is dissatisfaction. It's the idea that, okay, you have a floppy disk and one image can occupy the whole floppy disk. Someone starts saying, okay, fine, you know what? Let's find different memory methods and everything. And some of them have come and gone along the way, but that's mm-hmm. the point, dissatisfaction. And to talk about one of the things that Claire is pointing out, actually, that dissatisfaction has been hijacked by capitalism, because one of the things that capitalism does is makes you dissatisfied with what you have and make you want to have something different.
The psychology, right? Of dissatisfaction.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have a perfectly functioning automobile, but you want a flashier one because advertising tells you, okay, that was last year's model, get this year's model. Or it tells you, well, you could be slimmer and you don't even have to exercise. We can, you know, we can do it for you wholesale we can remember it for you wholesale. You know, you don't remember things, fine, we'll get you a better phone. All right. Mm-hmm. There's always something that will make you dissatisfied and that will make you change things. You know, we're not happy with our lifespan, so we extended our lifespan. We're not happy with illness. We're not happy with deformity. So we invented plastic surgery. And then say, actually, oh, it's not just deformity. We can use it to enhance our culturally determined idea of beauty too. So, hey, mm-hmm. look, we can shave off bits. We can put a cleft in your chin and make, you know, we can make you perfect. It's dissatisfaction that you know, that guides all of the technology, that pushes it. And it is what, again, has been infected by our various ways of thinking.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, I'm very satisfied with the conversation that we've had and all the ideas that we've managed to cover. And I know, especially Claire, the dissatisfaction that all of you feel about certain aspects of the world fuel your writing. And I know that all of you are going to continue to go on writing amazing stories based on the things that you're seeing in the world and the ideas that you want to challenge. So I'm very, very thankful that you took the time to hang out with me today, to be a part of TBRCon 2023. And Veronica, Tade, Claire, Krithika, and Mike, thank you so much. And this was a fantastic talk. So
Thanks, Adrian.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. We're not going to leave just yet. Yeah. You can all promote your stuff real quick. So, Veronica, let people know where they can find you on social media and where they can pick up your books. Or what books you have coming out, because I know Arch Conspirators, but very soon.
Yeah, so Arch Conspirator, which is the Antigone retelling, comes out February 23rd. And my latest book, Poster Girl, came out in October. That's the dystopian mystery that I talked about earlier. I'm on Instagram, usually at Veronica Roth, and I'm on the interwebs at veronicarothbooks.com.
Fantastic. Mike?
I've got a book coming out in March called Infinity Gate, which is a sci-fi novel. I also had a short novella that came out in November called Last Night at the Stardome Lounge. And I'm on Twitter. I'm not anywhere else on social media, but I'm easy to find on Twitter.
And that is at MichaelCarey191. And Mike and I just did a reading this morning. So if you want to hear two sections of Infinity Gate, go check that out. And Claire, where can people find you? What you got out?
I am at ClaireNorth42 on Twitter and also on Mastodon because, hey, Elon Musk. Current book is Ithaca, which is Penelope, Queen of Ithaca versus Pirates. And there's sequels, which is more of that.
She already wrote them. They're coming. Don't you worry. Thank you so much. And Tade?
I am not on social media anywhere. You cannot find me anywhere.
Oh, living the dream.
I have a love-hate relationship with social media. But you can find my books anywhere books are sold. You can find the Rosewater trilogy. You can find The Murders of Molly Southbourne. My most recent science fiction book is Far From the Light of Heaven. It's everywhere. And my latest book is Jackdaw, which is a really disturbing horror novella, which is really nasty. So don't buy that if you want to sleep at night. But, you know, but otherwise, yeah, that, you know, and I'm working on something about a warrior in the 6th century right now, but that's not going to be ready until much, much later.
That sounds very intriguing. But thank you. And Krithika, where can people find you? And when is The Surviving Sky hitting stores?
Well, The Surviving Sky is hitting stores on June 13th this year. It's out by Titan Books and, again, available wherever books are sold. And I am at Krithika H. Rao, so the spelling that you see on your screens, at Krithika H. Rao on TikTok, Instagram, and TikTok. I know, nobody mentioned TikTok, so I will mention it. Yeah, and I am on that. So, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok.
Awesome. And once again, thank you all so much for joining me for this. This was such a fun discussion. So I really appreciate it.